babies are born? Are they born wired for moral decision-making? I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. You're about to hear of remarkable research, including research done at Yale University by my guest Paul Bloom and his colleagues, watching babies make choices in favor of the good person or the bad person. The book about it is clear, sometimes witty, and fascinating. Just Babies is a look at the origins of good and evil. Babies know it and show it. Author Paul Bloom is the Brooks and Suzanne Reagan Professor of Psychology at Yale. He's done 6 books, including How Pleasure Works, the subject of a TED Talk that has been viewed more than 1 million times. We love having Paul Bloom on this show. Welcome, Paul. It's good to see you.
Thank you for having me back. It's good to see you, too.
So I would like to say that much of Paul's lab work at Yale is done in collaboration with Karen Wynn. He happens to be married to her, and a sharp team of people. And you see them referenced in the book, even though they have separate labs and separate interests. They've come together on this book. So that was a shout-out to Karen, on your behalf.
I appreciate that.
Okay, so I thought we'd start, since you're looking at whether babies are born hardwired with a sense of morality, by describing one experiment to kind of get at how this is done, and then we'll get to the punchline.
Well, I'll tell you about one of the first experiments we've done where we take babies who are, say, 6 months old or 9 months old, and we show them a one-act play. And in this play, a character is struggling to get up the hill. One character helps it up the hill, and a second character pushes it down the hill. Then we show the babies these two characters, the one that helped the person and the one that hindered the person. And what we find is, with the youngest babies we test, they prefer the one that helped it over the one that hindered it.
How do you know?
Well, we know in different ways. For 9-month-olds, we know because that's the one they'll reach for when we show them the two characters. For older kids, we get a little bit fancier. So we find we could ask 14-month-olds to reward one of the characters by giving it a treat, and they'll reward the good guy. We could ask them to punish one of the characters by taking away a treat, and then they'll punish the bad guy. We can then get even more complicated than that. We have this good guy and bad guy, and then we introduce another character who is mean to the good guy or mean to the bad guy. It turns out that they like the character who's mean to the bad guy. They don't like a character who's mean to a good guy, but a character who's mean to a bad guy, the babies will like that character as well.
So what does that say to you?
I think it suggests that babies are born with a moral sense. We're born that this meshes well with other research showing that young babies have compassion and empathy. They have a rudimentary sense of justice and fairness, and they can distinguish good from evil. So the foundations for morality, for the moral lives that you and I as adults have, I think shows up very early on in development.
So if you are someone who believes that nature equips us, has equipped us with all these things because we needed them early on, why did nature equip us with this moral sense if this is true?
So in some way, it used to be thought that the idea that people would be innately kind or innately moral clashes with evolutionary theory, clashes with a scientific view. But we now know that this isn't true. We now know since Darwin, it's been clear that for a social animal like us, it could be adaptive to be kind to others, particularly kind to those who are akin and kind to those who we are in repeated interaction with. In some way, nice guys finish first.
So did nature do this to us because we would need to get along in groups?
Yes, I think so. And I think also because we benefit from being kind to our kin. To our children, to our siblings, and so on. I think this is why we've been endowed with this moral nature. We also need to be able to judge other members of our group. Are they good guys or bad guys? Should we interact with them? So in some way, this is the good news, that nature has equipped us with this powerful moral system. The flip side of it is that from an evolutionary perspective, you wouldn't expect us to be nice to everybody. You wouldn't expect us to be nice to other groups or people in faraway lands. And in fact, this initial morality is, I think, also tragically limited.
Yeah. How does that begin to show up when you do your research and look at other people's research?
So it shows up particularly when you look at how we act towards strangers. So you and I can be kind to strangers. We can be we can give money to strangers, give blood to strangers. We won't harm strangers. But it turns out developmentally, this is a late accomplishment. Young children, toddlers, even older children are surprisingly indifferent, even cold-blooded, to people that they don't know.
I have seen some parents, force is too strong a word, but strongly encourage their children not to do that thing of turning away, acting rude, and they're civilizing the child. You know, they're trying to teach the child that's not okay for you to do this, and that these parents believe this is a way, well, again, of civilizing. You know, now I'm wondering, is that a good thing to do for a parent to do?
I think to some extent it is. So I think the story is a little bit complicated. I'm saying that it's wrong to say that babies are morally empty, that they're little psychopaths. They do have a moral sense from the start. But because this moral sense is limited, they need civilizing. They need, in order to become moral adults, in order to be kind to people they don't know, in order to have a broad moral circle, they need culture and parents to sort of educate them and reason with them to expand their moral sense.
So why is it that if we're born with this moral sense, you say it's innate, we're born with it, what happens to us? Is it the lack of civilization? I mean, there are some people, obviously, who have, wiring issues. Their brains are wired differently, and so they have great trouble in life. Others through circumstances. What happens to us that if you look around the world, there's so much evil. There's so much cruelty. Life is so unpredictable. So many bad things go on. So if we're all born innately moral, how does this coexist?
So there are different answers to that question. It's a hard question. I think it's one of the most important questions of all. One answer is that people are different. We have a moral sense. But as Thomas Jefferson pointed out, just as with sort of every other aspect of our body, the strength of our morality differs from person to person. But another answer is that our moral emotions, our moral justifications can be directed, can be expanded, and can be staunched. A lot of the worst things that people do to one another, a lot of the most horrible things, are actually not despite our moral sense, but because of it. It's because we believe that people should be punished. It's because we believe that there's a threat against those we love that needs to be responded to. Most evil acts are not done by people rubbing their hands together and saying, look what an evil person I am. Rather, a lot of evil acts are done by people who say, I'm doing the right thing. This is legitimate punishment. This is revenge. This is payback. A lot of the most horrific genocidal movements in human history have been motivated by people who sincerely believed they were doing the right thing, perhaps doing God's work.
Which brings us to religion. People doing things that we might find horrific in God's name.
There's a lot of debate, as you could guess, over the effects of religion on morality. And there's no clear answer. It turns out a lot of research has been done. And you could have perfectly good atheists and perfectly bad atheists, perfectly good religious people and perfectly bad religious people. What religion often does, though, is codify a system of morals. And sometimes these could be morals that even a secular person could get behind, say, about the virtues of charity. Sometimes these are kind of savage morals, like advocating slavery or genocide or various forms of bigotry, that I think we're right to reject. And even in many contemporary religious people see these prescriptions as part of their religious codes, and I think justifiably say we're not going to adopt those.
So you don't believe in, remember Lord of the Flies, and I remember as a young person reading that book and being stunned by it. It was really affecting to me. You know, these young kids left to their own devices who become, you know, just monstrous.
Yeah.
So what about that? You know, do you think a child left to its own devices, if born moral, what would happen? That child is in a group. You know, if you remember Lord of the Flies,
yeah.
In a group. So what could we expect if everybody's born with a sense of morality, I wonder what happens.
It's a hard question, and I'm not necessarily saying that left unaffected, we would be perfectly kind to us. We're born of a sense of morality, but we're born of other things too. We're born of certain selfish desires. We're born with a sense of status and not wanting to be the low person on the totem pole, perhaps wanting to dominate others. We're born of certain needs. And these clash with morality. They clash in some of our studies with babies and young children, and they clash for adults. There are things that I do that I sort of recognize might be wrong, but there's things I want. And I think in our day-to-day lives, even when asking, say, how much money should I give to that homeless man? You balance your own comfort and security and money over what you could see as a moral obligation. So saying babies are moral creatures, saying that we're all moral creatures, it doesn't follow from this that we're necessarily always good.
And that we act it out. So choices are made through a life. Circumstances come into play. In a way, I'm trying to set you up to talk about that experiment. When I was asking about groups, I think there was one you cite where they put kids together. There were two studies that were really interesting. One, they put kids together based on their astrological signs. And then didn't they begin to identify with each other and think of themselves as having the properties of that astrological sign?
They did. So the backdrop for this sort of work is that one of the dark sides of human nature and our morality is we tend to be very particularly moral to those within our in-group, those people we ally with, and often brutal, cold-blooded to those in our out-group. And we're extremely willing, extremely prone to stigmatize and stereotype. And what's interesting, perhaps troubling, is we can do so on the most arbitrary of distinctions. So there are experiments that broke kids down into astrological signs and find that then they identify with their sign and they treat other signs differently. There's research that has half the kids wearing blue T-shirts, half the kids wearing red T-shirts. The T-shirts are distributed randomly at first, but pretty soon the kids identify with their own T-shirt color and they think that their T-shirt color is better than the kids having the other T-shirt color. You could also do it on the basis of a flip of a coin. And these experiments with kids have been motivated by exactly the same experiments with adults. You bring 200 adults into a room, you randomly split them up into two teams by the flip of a coin, and then you say to that person, putting yourself aside, what do you think of the members of your team compared to the other team? And often people say, I think it just turned out that we're better, and that more money should go to us, and that less money should go to the other team.
This explains the Democrats and the Republicans. So stay right where you are. Paul Bloom, who is author of this book just out, it's called Just Babies, and it's all about the origins of good and evil. His research and the research of others that he quotes showing that we are born with empathy, hardwired for empathy, compassion, a sense of good and evil, a sense of morality, and we're looking at that. We welcome your calls in just a little while. We'll be right back.
Baby did a bad, bad thing. 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 You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two?
Find out what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. My guest, Yale University psychologist and researcher Paul Bloom, is back. His new book, Just Babies, is about experiments with babies showing they are equipped with empathy, compassion, and a sense of right and wrong. To see the book, go to our website, WNPR.org, and click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. So, Paul, you were just saying that that in groups we tend to identify with others in the group and think well of ourselves, think we're better than others based on group. And I made a joke about Democrats and Republicans. We see this probably with religion, too, any group. It makes me think about homophobia and how people in the gay equality movement have been wondering for a long time what could be said and done to make the average person not look at a gay citizen as other, but to see the similarities that are so common among people. What do you think of when I say that to you?
So hatred towards homosexuals and discrimination towards homosexuals is, I think, comes naturally to us, in part because we're often repelled by the body. So I have a chapter in my book that talks about reactions to people's physical bodies, reactions of disgust towards sexuality, towards food. And this is something which cultures almost universally have and direct it towards some of their members. And so I think the way to shake this, and I think that history has shown that it's very successful, is by expressing to people that these outgroups are actually sort of normal people you could interact with, you could feel empathy and compassion with. In other words, to establish friendships between these people from the outgroups and those who would discriminate against them. Now, in the real world, you can imagine that that's impossible to do. But what's really interesting is the friendships don't have to be real. They could be virtual. They could be imaginary. And I think, and there's
so
some.
This is where fiction comes
this
in.
This is where fiction comes in. I think one of the biggest forces for social change in America has been the situation comedy. I think shows like The Cosby Show radically changed white Americans' impressions of African Americans, because it portrayed it introduced into their houses these perfectly affable, smart, pleasant African Americans, the Cosby family. And I think with regards to gay people, some of the biggest social transformations we've seen have happened in that domain precisely because of TV shows like Will and Grace and now Modern Family.
Ellen DeGeneres.
Exactly.
Before that, Rosie O'Donnell.
Exactly. So you might never know a gay person or never know you know a gay person, but you switch on a TV and all of a sudden there's these perfectly pleasant, funny people you're getting pleasure from being with. And at some level, the mind doesn't distinguish between what we see on TV or in fiction and the real world.
So to see someone like the ABC anchor Robin Roberts mm-hmm. announce just recently that she has had a longtime girlfriend, a partner, really struck me as important, because I thought, well, here is basically she's the most liked a journalist, morning anchor in television. And I thought, well, here's a whole swath of people at all income levels who have gotten to know her. Now she's saying, and by the way, I happen to be gay. And I think what an amazing experience. Maybe creating a sense among people that's not as scary as I thought it was.
I think that's exactly right. I don't mean this cynically, but it's kind of a Trojan horse strategy where, you know, if somebody, suppose I didn't like gay people, but my closest friend revealed to me that he or she was gay, I'd say, wow, this is going to change. This is likely to change a lot of things because I like this person. If I knew they were gay to start with, I might never establish that connection. So I think these events where suddenly people are revealed to be part of this outgroup you might have otherwise despised, to be gay or to be Jewish or something like that, can have a powerfully transformative effect.
So with things like, I remember Roots, the television series about slavery, and I think that had a giant impact on the culture, because that was a conversation, just as in Germany, nobody wanted to talk so much about the Holocaust. No, people in America didn't want to talk so much about the details of slavery.
That's right. I think that the media, in many ways, and particularly put aside journalism, particularly stories which capture our imagination, have a tremendous moral effect, not by preaching to us. I think people are actually very resistant to being preached at, but rather by introducing us to people who we would have never met before and expanding our empathy in that way.
I was thinking also, if you look at old people, Betty White, has done a tremendous amount for getting people to see how sharp, how witty, how savvy the older person can be.
I have a friend of mine, Mazarine Banaji, was a colleague of mine at Yale. Now she's at Harvard, and she studies implicit prejudice. And she said the most robust prejudice you'll ever find is not against blacks or gays or Muslims. It's against the elderly. People associate the elderly with negativity, with negative traits across the board. Even the elderly in these implicit, unconscious tasks associate the elderly with negativity. And so positive role models that tend to be older also, I think, could have a transformative effect.
You talk about this very same thing among blacks in the South, having a poor sort of image of themselves.
Yeah, so a lot of the stereotype literature and the bias, the experimental work on bias, it's not just that whites think less of blacks or straight people think less of gays. Often the group themselves who is discriminated against has themselves incorporated as part of their own identity this negative aspect of themselves. So there are these classic studies of it may be not surprising that in the 50s, white kids would rather play with white dolls than black dolls. But it was striking to many that black kids would also prefer to play with white dolls than black dolls. And these were the experimental findings that served as part of the basis for the Brown versus Board of Education legal decision. So it's at least one instance where psychology has made, an important social effect.
I would like to invite you to join the conversation with us. We have Paul Bloom here as a cognitive psychologist, researcher, and author. His book is Just Babies, about the origins of good and evil, and he is making the case that we are hardwired, born with a sense of empathy, compassion, morality. In the research that he does in his lab, research that Karen Wynn does at Yale, both with excellent teams, and research around the world, it's been gathered here in the book, and it is so fascinating, so readable, so understandable, and quite a look at the origins of good and evil, why we are the way we are. This would be the most amazing book. You know, I think about, and of course, it's here we are reading it just as everyday people, but I'm thinking about how amazing this would be to be taught in high school. Really, really start interesting conversations there, I think.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that the science of how we think about morality, how we think about right and wrong, how we think about in-groups versus out-groups, about disgust and empathy and compassion, is interesting, and it's also accessible.
And here's our number, 203-776-9677. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, 203-776-9677. I saw, one other scientist say, but Paul Bloom, how do you declare that morality is innate? And that we're absolutely born with this, because how could you test an infant who is just a few days old? For me, that seemed almost a silly question. But go ahead. Let's see what you do with it.
Well, we test very young babies. We've done experiments with three-month-olds. Now, it's always open for somebody to say, well, maybe the child learned in the first 3 months of life. And I think, as a scientist, we have to be open to these alternatives. My own belief is that you probably wouldn't find these abilities in newborns, because they need to, the brain needs to simply develop. It's like babbling or crawling or other capacities. Some systems have to sort of take time to grow. But if somebody wanted to argue that they're learned, they would need to sort of present a theory as to how they could have learned these things. One way in which we're sensitive to that concern in our research is we try to test babies on situations they would have never experienced before. Passing things back and forth and stealing things and hiding things in a box. Things that as two-year-olds they know plenty about. But these are children who are like 3 months old. They're like little meatloafs or blobs. And yet I'm so struck at how much they seem to know.
Well, what can you explain, as you do in the book, about what this signal they give, looking, where a baby's attention is a form of communicating something to you.
Right. So for a child, a baby around 6 months old, you could see how he or she reaches. But for 3 month olds, you can't. They can't really control their reaching. So how do you figure out what's in their heads? Well, the cue that developmental psychologists tend to use is eye movements. And we know certain things about eye movements. So if babies are looking at a display and they see something surprising, they'll look longer. And so would you. This is kind of why we use this measure. Or suppose you show two characters to a baby, one to the baby's right and the other to the baby's left. Which one will they look at? Well, we have a lot of evidence suggesting that they'll look at the one they like more. And once you know that, you can use this as a measure to see, are they sensitive to how somebody acts when determining how much to like them? Do they care about skin color? Do they care about gender? Do they care about language?
And so the longer they look, the more it gives you a sense that they're interested or they know something is changed or it's different.
That's right. That's right. So the longer they look and the direction that they look when given a choice is a measure of preference. And so, for instance, if you put down a child and on the child's right is a picture of his mother and on the left is a picture of the stranger, I will bet you the child will turn to the right. Because, you know, it's familiar, it's somebody the baby likes. But now, what if it was a good guy and a bad guy? Well, we know the answer. The baby will turn to the one who's good and turn away from the one who's bad.
I'm trying to think who did the study of watching Kyle Pruitt, watching babies whose fathers had grown a beard. And they were enormously upset because, you know, this had a huge impact on the fathers because they thought, well, the blob in the crib really doesn't know me. And then the father appears with a beard and the baby's tremendously upset. And it's a big bonding experience for the fathers, according to Kyle, oh my goodness, this communication is two ways.
That's fascinating. Yeah. It's one of the, I think, the benefits of keeping an eye on the baby research, particularly if you're a parent of a baby, is you'll be impressed by how much your baby knows and the extent to which your baby has developed expectations and knowledge of you. It is a two-way street very, very early on.
We have Bimmy, who has called 203-776-WNPR to join the conversation with me. I'm Faith Middleton and Paul Bloom of Yale University. Hi, Bimmy. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, Bimmy. Go ahead.
I was in reference to the talk about babies, young children playing with dolls.
Yeah.
And which would they prefer? And interestingly, I'm Caucasian. I'm white. And my favorite of all dolls was an Amel Sandra doll, a little black baby doll. And I absolutely adored that little doll. And yet, when I got married, I married a white man, and then we divorced, and I married a black man. So I think a lot of it has to do with their upbringing. My mother absolutely never said anything about race or anything. You know, there was no consciousness about being different.
Oh, that's so interesting.
I think a lot of it has to do with that.
Oh, Bimmy. Wow. Okay, go ahead, Paul.
No, that's a great story, and I think you're right about it having to do with upbringing. So children, babies are very strongly inclined to break up the world into us versus them, but they don't initially do it on the basis of skin color. In fact, one of the ways in which the environment, which parents affect how children grow up, is children need to learn what distinctions to make. And if you don't make a big deal about skin color, children won't make a big deal about it. There are studies of 7-year-olds who grow up in communities where black and white kids get along just fine, and they don't distinguish on the basis of race. If they are raised in a society where people make a big thing of race, or if the black kids, you know, sit at one table and the white kids at another, then they do glom onto it, and they do take race very seriously.
Thank you so much, Bimmy.
Thank you.
What an interesting comment you made. Thank you.
Thank you, Bimmy.
Bimmy has reminded me that one of my grandmothers brought a baby, a doll, to Christmas. And when the package was opened for one of the little kids, the doll was black. And I remember that, and I will say all of us, because I'm included, stared, was speechless at the baby. I think it struck us all. You know, you can almost see the words, but the baby is black.
Yeah.
You know, is it? And so there I was confronted with some innate thing about that this white child in our family was supposed to get a white doll. And I shocked myself.
Well, for the society I grew up in, and I'm sure you grew up in too, race was very important. You know, people noticed race. It made a big difference for who would interact with who, what jobs people would have, and so on. So even if you come to the view that it's morally wrong to discriminate, you know, we're now so wired up to appreciate it that we can't put it aside.
Wow. Now, this is a different Bimmy. Okay. Bimmy, Faith Middleton with Paul Bloom of Yale University. Welcome to our show. His book is called Just Babies. Go ahead.
Yes. This Bimmy is a retired school psychologist from Brantford and used to live across the trolley trail from you.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
and,
good.
I'm calling about this. I'm fascinated with the subject of this book, and I have a question. Has any of this been tested in terms of autistic babies?
That's actually an excellent question. My wife, Karen Wynn, is doing collaborative work with people at the Yale Child Study Center, and that's exactly what she's looking at. She's looking at whether or not children who are at risk for autism or children diagnosed with autism will show the same moral decision patterns as normally developing children. We know that kids with autism differ in certain ways in their understanding of other people's minds. And so it's an interesting and, I think, important question whether or not they show any moral differences.
Yeah, I'd be how do you spell your wife's name? Because I'd like to look up what she's doing.
It's Wynn, W-Y-N-N.
And her first name?
Karen.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much.
This is really fascinating.
Yeah, well,
these are fascinating. Autistic kids, among others, and I just would love to know what she finds out.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. So to get to autistic kids, if these kids have a wiring issue that causes them not to be able to read the emotion in another person, you know, they have to learn that skill almost from the outside. You know, how would that affect what your theory is?
So that's exactly what we're wondering. So a lot of things are problematic for kids with autism or autism spectrum disorder. And one, as you point out, is they have problems reading the minds of others. They have problems figuring out what other people believe and what other people feel. And so the question which we're wondering is this moral capacity that we're interested in, the ability to judge good from bad, how connected is that to the capacity to understand other people? And it's kind of an open question. It could be one and the same. It could be that once you know about people, an understanding of good and bad is just part and parcel of it. But it's also possible that they're separate neural systems, that they're in different parts of the brain, and that one of them could be damaged and the other one could remain intact.
Mm-hmm. Because so often children with somewhere on the autism spectrum are very capable of having their feelings hurt. And so it's not as if they don't understand what pain is. You know what I'm saying?
I do. And in fact, what's kids with autism are often described as having somewhat of a deficit in empathy. And in some cases, that's true. But the thing to notice about these kids is they tend to be very decent. They tend to be decent, loving kids. They tend to often the kids with Asperger syndrome have a good sense of right and wrong and morality. They're far more often the victims of malice and cruelty than the perpetrators of it.
Yeah. This brings us for just a moment to, because you mentioned Asperger's, and I thought about the Newtown shooter, Adam Lanza. And after reading your book, I was thinking about him a lot, because you do discuss the sociopath and So when you hear, I know you're not an expert on his case or his psychology, but when you hear his story, what are you thinking about? Is this a boy who, had he been put in a situation of more social contact, had that been fostered in him, might this have turned out differently?
So it's a truism that the way we turn out is a combination of our genes and our environment. And I think that this is actually important to keep in mind for a case like Adam Lanza. I haven't followed the case, but suppose, as I've heard, that he started off with problems. He was, let's just say he was a bad seed in certain ways. Still, how he was raised, the experiences he had, who reached out to him, would make a profound difference for how he turned out. So there are kids who are born with all sorts of problems, including maybe problems with empathy, with caring. And they grow up to be productive, fine, normal adults because their abilities were nurtured and their deficits were controlled for and were treated. So it's in nobody's destiny to become a mass killer. People might be born with less empathy than others, with less caring than others. They may be born with problems. But plainly, the case like Newtown is extraordinarily rare. And I think it could have only happened if there was a combination of bad genes maybe, but also a very bad luck in how he was raised. And, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. I'm just saying that that if things had turned out differently, this would have never happened.
We're going to take a quick break, and we welcome your calls at 203-776-9677 here on the Faith Middleton Show. Conversation, a fascinating one, as expected, with Paul Bloom of Yale University, author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. We'll be right back. And as we go back to our conversation with Paul Bloom of Yale University, a cognitive psychologist and author of Just Babies, I wanted to mention this to you. This is a way to say I love you and enjoy fantastic food and wine and a beautiful setting. Join me the week of Valentine's Day for my fifth annual Heart to Heart Dinner Dance, February 12th at the Society Room, downtown Hartford, featuring a celebrated team of chefs working to make it a magical night for you, and wines from the gorgeous Frederick Wildman portfolio for this sit-down dinner, music from Alex Nakamovsky, his vocalists and orchestra, special effects lighting from Audio Media Solutions. Dress is festive, your choice. Tickets are $90 per person to benefit WNPR and the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze. Plenty of parking at the site. Our talented team of chefs includes David Sellers of Max Fish, Jeffrey Lazotte on 20, Brad Stabinski, Chamard Vineyards, Jason Sobozinski of Caseus, Jeffrey Crawford of Jordan Caterers, Stefan Drago of Bell Terrace, and Christopher Prosperi of Metro Beast. The menu is mouth-watering, I can tell you that. This event sells out every time. Seating is limited. Tickets at WNPR.org. Special thanks to UConn Health Center's Pat and Jim Cardiology, Calhoun Cardiology Center, and Fiddleheads. I can't wait to see you there February 12th. Go to WNPR.org to be part of my Food Schmooze signature event. You will see the box. My guess, this is the other reason I'm lucky, not just to go to a great dinner with you. I hope you will come. But to talk once again with Paul Bloom. We love having him on the show, and he's done another book. It's called Just Babies, and it's about, it's an exploration from the research that he and others have done with infants on the origins of good and evil. And Paul, let's take a call, and then I want to ask you about, as you talked about babies naturally just turning away from the other, from the stranger, you know, not the mother, not the father. And yet later on, as they start to loosen up and become friendly again and then block out all the differences. So I want to talk with you about that. But Lucian, Faith Middleton with Paul Bloom, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Lucian.
I'm not a scientist, just an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And my observation is that all the babies are born selfish. That's how they survive. If they're happy, you know it. If they're unhappy, you really know it. And I thought, as to good and evil, they would look at somebody and say, "Will this person be nice to me?" And that would attract them to that person. An evil person would not be nice to me, so they would not be attracted to that person.
So, Lucian, this is such a good question about self-interest. To what degree is all this motivated by self-interest? That's a great question.
It is a great question. It's something which we're very interested in the lab. So we view this as a foundation for morality. And that's not necessarily inconsistent with it being grounded in self-interest in some regard, because I think morality is an evolutionary adaptation that has built to some extent into self-interest. But to go after specifics, you might worry that maybe kids are just going towards the good guy because they expect to be treated better if they contact the good guy. And it's just a sort of selfish bias. Our punishment studies get at this. So we do these studies, and we're very much concerned just by the point you're making. We do these studies where there's a good guy and a bad guy. And then we ask these toddlers to take away something from one of them. Now we predict that they'll approach the bad guy. And in fact, that's exactly what they do. So what this suggests is that they're not merely being drawn to whoever is safer or nicer, but they're willing to go to approach a bad guy if they feel it's just and it's right. And that suggests that there really is at least some morality at work here.
Hmm. So it's interesting, isn't it, Lucian?
Well, yeah, I still think you'd smile at somebody that was good to you.
I think so, too.
And by the same token, if somebody was not good to you, you might want to punish them somehow.
Well, thank you for bringing up an interesting topic, Lucian.
Okay,
take care. What about the idea that the babies turn away from the stranger just naturally?
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk in the book about how they reach an age where that all reverses itself.
Well, We find that babies will go through a certain stage, or young children go a certain stage, where they're much more willing to interact with strangers and they're much more willing to act with other people. But whenever you do the research carefully and you look at helping or sharing or empathetic pain, there's one finding that always shows up over and over and over again, which is that there's a difference between those people that the babies know and those that they don't know. Babies at the age where they can help will help friends and family far more than they'll help strangers. Younger babies who flinch in pain when they see someone else in pain will show more of a reaction when there's someone else or someone they know than a stranger. Later on, when you look at 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, we've studied kids that age, kids can be very fair and generous and kind towards those they get along with.
Mm-hmm.
And utterly cold-blooded towards strangers. And we see that in ourselves as well, of course, in adults. None of this totally goes away. So as adults in our society, we could often be very generous towards strangers. But still, it's a very rare person who would give more to a neighbor's child than to their own child.
You're getting at why the culture in schools is so important. Rules set up, groups where kids are taught, if they have the capacity to be both good and evil, born with a moral sense but afraid and alienated by the other, if you've got a kid in school who's different in some way, then the culture of the school seems to matter tremendously.
I think that's certainly true, and the culture more generally. So I'm very interested in my research as to what parts of morality are part of human nature, are hardwired, and are universal. But over the last 100 years even, there have been profound changes in our moral lives. The homicide rate has dropped by half in the last 30 years. We think about homosexuals and racial minorities and men and women in totally different ways. Where the expansion of our morality has expanded, has grown massively. We think about bullying and ostracism in very different ways. None of this could be genetic because it just happened in a blink of an eye. And this is proof positive that culture and schools and parents can cause profound differences in our moral understanding and our moral action.
You make me think about the importance of, say, the World Bank investing in these countries in Africa, let's say, where you see, the death penalty if someone is gay, or these warring tribal factions, the Christians and the Muslims across Africa, you know, the fear that there will be some kind of religious war. I understand why government agencies go in and spend money trying to change so that the kind of change that we've seen here, though it seems slow to us on the ground, when you look at it historically, as you do, These investments we've made have made a difference.
Well, we certainly know, and Steve Pinker has a wonderful book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he chronicles the decline of violence over human history. And there are all these horrific things going on in the world that are just totally shocking. But put in a broader perspective, we are much nicer to one another. For instance, we kill each other far less than we did 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And I think what this suggests is that in addition, we have our innate moral understanding, but we also have moral discoveries, moral insights, such as the wrongness of slavery or the notion of democracy or equality. And, you know, these have spread across the world like good ideas.
Paul, why do you do this work? Why did you start doing this? What made you, what grabbed you by the throat, where you said, I have got to do this?
I think this this book, Just Babies, for me is sort of a perfect storm of interest, because on the one hand, I'm really interested in babies. I've done this collaborative work with my wife, Karen Wynn, and I'm just fascinated by what we could find by studying these young creatures. But I'm also really interested in right and wrong. I mean, like everybody else, my whole life I've struggled with questions. Am I doing the right thing? What about my politics, my attitudes towards other people? And I've wondered, why am I so confident that this is right and this is wrong? Mm-hmm. And so the book represents the convergence of an interest in human nature and an interest in morality.
Do you ever think that in your life you're in some ways training to do the right thing when called upon?
I've often wondered, when called upon, will I act properly?
Yeah, yeah.
But I also think, and I think that maybe this isn't a measure of a good person. What the measure of a good person is, how we act in our longstanding relationships and our longstanding decisions, what kind of parent we are, what kind of son or daughter we are, husband or wife, partner. And I think that morality often isn't sort of how one acts in a pinch, but how one lives one's life.
Mm, that's good. He's a good man.
I just thought that up on the fly.
I know. Great to have you on the show. I loved this book, every word. It was just really fascinating. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And we'd love to have Karen Wynn on the show to talk about autism. This week, as you know, we're going to be having another Food Schmooze, and I think you will enjoy it. And right now, you can find online cocktails, food, recipes, all kinds of things up there at WNPR. As always, this show is about the richness of life. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
On the back.